Today is Tuesday, September 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump has fired his National Security Advisor, John Bolton. North Korea fires more missiles, but what does it signal for proposed talks?
Welcome to North Korea's 2019 maximum pressure campaign against the Trump administration.
And the World Health Organization is calling for action to stop the global suicide epidemic. Those stories and more are all coming up next. U.S. President Donald Trump has fired his National Security Advisor, John Bolton. The announcement came via Twitter, with the president writing, quote, "I informed John Bolton last night that his services are no longer needed at the White House. I disagreed strongly with many of his suggestions, as did others in the administration, and therefore asked John for his resignation, which was given to me this morning." Joining us on the phone is VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Steve.
So, Steve, what can you tell us about the exact timeline of the events? Because there seem to be conflicting stories coming out of the White House and what Mr. Bolton wrote on Twitter.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the president arrived about noon, and this was just 90 minutes before Bolton was supposed to be on the White House podium along with the Treasury Secretary
right.
and the Secretary of State, came out and said that he had essentially asked for Bolton's resignation. Then a few minutes later after that, Bolton on Twitter said that the president never asked him for his resignation, that he had had a discussion with the president last evening about resigning, and the president had told him that they should discuss it today.
What exactly is the White House saying about those two stories? Are they commenting on it?
No, there's been no elaboration on that at this point. Now, if this White House briefing with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and Secretary of State Pompeo does start in 20 minutes or so, they're certainly going to be asked about it. Now, the White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley, as we speak, is live on the Fox News channel being asked about this. That's a network generally sympathetic to the mm-hmm. president, so he may not be getting very tough questions about the discrepancies, but Gidley will be walking back in a moment or so and will be asked about it, or reporters such as my colleague Patsy Widakuswater, who's out there right now, will try to question him about this as well.
Trump, in his tweet, noted disagreements about policies. Since you're at the White House, what did you see in your reporting that reflected that?
Well, Trump knew what he was getting with Bolton before he hired him. Bolton had been a commentator on Fox News Channel and espoused his views quite widely as a hardliner, a hawk. Trump once said in the Oval Office that Bolton never saw a war he didn't like. But it was all too much for the president, obviously. They had big disagreements on Iran, North Korea, the Middle East, and most recently about inviting the Taliban to Camp David in these Afghan peace talks. So I think this is surprising only in the timing, not that John Bolton would be lasting in this position for another year and a half or another 4 years if Trump were to be reelected.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Thank you so much for joining us on the phone today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
North Korea has offered to resume stalled nuclear talks with the United States, but has also conducted yet another weapons test. VOA's Bill Gallo has more on the North Korea's testing of ballistic missiles that send some conflicting signals.
Hours after offering to sit face-to-face with U.S. officials, North Korea launched its 10th round of weapons since May. South Korea's military says the two projectiles traveled 330 kilometers, another short-range test. The tests appear designed to increase leverage ahead of nuclear talks, if those talks ever take place. Late Monday, senior North Korean diplomat Choi Sun-hee said Pyongyang was willing to sit down with U.S. officials in late September. But she warned the United States must present a new calculation method or risk ending the talks altogether. Even if talks did occur, Seoul-based political analyst June Park says it's not clear either side has softened their stance.
What will come out of the meeting is still under question, because Choi Soon-hee has been noted as saying she expects to see a different kind of calculation method. And I'm not quite sure whether the U.S. is ready to present something like that.
Talks have been stalled since a second summit in February between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ended abruptly without a deal. Trump rejected Kim's demand for sanctions relief in return for partial denuclearization. Kim agreed in June to resume working-level talks, but North Korean officials have not shown up. North Korea has given the United States an end-of-the-year deadline to change its approach, but Park says it's not clear how firm that deadline is.
At this point, under their statement, it sounds very firm, but if ever there is a meeting held, let's say, during the fall, and they are working towards some kind of an agreement, you need time to work on it, I think it could be a flexible date.
Trump has not responded to the latest launch. The U.S. president has said he has no problem with North Korea's other short-range launches. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
On the phone is Harry Kazianis, the Senior Director for Korea Studies at the Center for the National Interest. What is going on with North Korea? They said they're interested in denuclearization talks. They continue to launch missiles. They're putting extra pressure on the United States to come essentially back to the table with a better offer. What's going on?
Simple. Welcome to North Korea's 2019 maximum pressure campaign against the Trump administration. I think what Pyongyang has figured out is that I think they do want to deal with the United States, but just like has always been the case with North Korea, it's going to be on their terms. I think what they are willing to offer is essentially what they offered in Hanoi, with probably a little bit less in terms of what they're looking for. I think the North Koreans would still be willing to offer a major nuclear facility, such as the Yongbyon nuclear facility, which is big. It's over 350 buildings. It's the crown jewel of their nuclear complex. It's nothing to sneeze at. The question is, what will the Trump administration offer in return? There doesn't seem to be any movement within the administration. I've checked in actually with several colleagues in very, very high positions in the administration who deal in the North Korean issue. So far, they're not signaling to me or anybody else who they're willing to talk to that they're willing to offer any sanctions relief or even any temporary sanctions relief. So I think where this hangs right now is the Trump administration willing to maybe go into a small deal, willing to give some sort of sanctions relief? If the answer is no, we could end up going back to the days of fire and fury in 2017 when North Korea decides to test ICBMs.
Is fire and fury really a possibility? Because if you look at the long historical context of talks with North Korea, there's always this cycle, right, where North Korea does all these tests, whether it be ICBMs or even smaller ballistic missile tests, in the hopes of getting some sanctions relief. And then every once in a while, a government or even the six-party talks will give in and alleviate some of the sanctions for a period of time, and North Korea behaves for a while, and then they start everything back up again. Is this more of the same? We're going back to the true status quo with North Korea?
I have to admit, there is a very cyclical nature in these talks with North Korea going back to the last 10, maybe even 15 or 20 years. There is one wild card in all this, and that's Donald J. Trump. I think we have to realize that Trump is a very, very different foreign policy player when it comes to North Korea. You know, back in 2017, he was very much a hawk on this issue. Even seemed like he might even be thinking about regime change with some of the comments, threats of nuclear war, threats to utterly destroy North Korea. But then he seemed to change tack when Kim Jong-un changed his tack in 2018. So I think the question here is, what is President Trump thinking? Is he willing to make a deal with North Korea? Is he thinking legacy? Is he thinking about trying to get some, maybe even a small deal before the presidential elections? This way, conservative media, Fox News, other outlets can sort of use that as a great talking point to the American electorate. Or does Trump start to get frustrated? Does he keep seeing these missile tests? Does he see conservatives start attacking him for being, quote unquote, weak on North Korea and decide to get more aggressive?
Well, you bring up an interesting point about being weak on North Korea, because, you know, this missile launch is coming off the heels of really the failed Taliban peace negotiations. So is the Trump administration really under the gun, so to speak, to come up with a huge deal with North Korea?
Well, I think that it would be smart for the Trump administration to have some sort of foreign policy legacy builder. And, you know, that may or may not happen. I think we have to all understand that Donald Trump is not the standard foreign policy player.
Harry Kazianis is the Senior Director of Korea Studies over at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you so much for your insight today.
Thank you.
The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency had a source with high-level access to the Kremlin who played a key role in the assessment that President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign aimed at the 2016 U.S. election, according to the New York Times and CNN in their reports Monday. Neither U.S. news organization identified the source by name, but several Russian outlets did so. At a Tuesday news briefing, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the person named in the Russian reports did work for the Russian president's office, but not in a high-ranking position and did not have direct contact with President Putin. Both news organizations said the source was extracted from Russia in 2017 after declining an earlier offer to leave. CNN said the decision to pull the source out of such a valuable position was made in part because of concerns of mishandling of classified information by U.S. President Donald Trump and members of his administration. The CIA rejected that statement, telling CNN it only makes decisions based on, quote, objective analysis and sound collection, end quote. The Times linked the extraction to media coverage of the revelations about the Russian election interference campaign and questions about the source in the Kremlin. It said the source's life is in danger and pointed to the example of Sergei Skripal, a former Russian agent who was convicted of spying for Britain and was poisoned with nerve agents last year. The report says the loss of an asset with such access within the Kremlin has left the U.S. intelligence community without information about Russia's current actions and any plans to influence other elections. Among other top stories in the world, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said Tuesday it would be extremely inappropriate for the United States or any other foreign government to interfere in the city's affairs. A media watchdog has determined that Eritrea is the world's most censored country. In addition, the watchdog said the Eritrean government was the worst jailer of journalists in the sub-Saharan Africa region. A UN report finds human rights violations and repression of fundamental freedoms in Nicaragua continue a year after a violent crackdown on dissent killed more than 300 protesters. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with our mobile app. This is VOA News.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the biggest threat to President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in 2021 may be a 37-year-old musician. The future of Uganda on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Today is World Suicide Prevention Day. The World Health Organization is calling for action to stop the global epidemic, which every year takes the lives of an estimated 800,000 people. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, the launch of the WHO's latest data on global suicides.
The World Health Organization says suicides are preventable and fewer people would die by self-inflicted means if more nations employed proven suicide prevention strategies. And yet the United Nations agency says only 38 countries are taking life-saving actions. WHO reports every 40 seconds one person around the world commits suicide, with young people particularly vulnerable. Data show suicide is the second leading cause of death among those between 15 and 29 years old and the leading cause of death among teenage girls between the ages of 15 and 19. The report finds the highest number of suicides, 79%, are in low and medium income countries, while suicide rates are highest in the richer countries. WHO scientist in the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, Alexandra Fleischman, says pesticide self-poisoning is a common means of suicide in agricultural areas of poorer nations.
It's about one-fifth of all suicide are happening with this method. And we know that it's oftentimes happening out of the moment because of distress, impulsively. Usually the persons are ambivalent about taking their own life. And in this moment, they should not have the quick and ready access to the means of suicide.
Fleischman says many of these suicides can be prevented by banning highly hazardous pesticides in high-risk countries. She says preventive measures also should be taken in regard to other common methods of suicide, notably hanging and firearms. WHO reports important risk factors include a previous suicide attempt, mental health problems, depression, loss, stress, violence, and alcohol abuse. Interventions with a proven record of success include restricting access to means, responsible media reporting that does not glamorize suicide, and teaching young people how to cope with life stresses. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Queensland is facing its worst brush fire threat in recorded history, as more than 50 fires burn across the Australian state. Phil Mercer reports further south, crews are battling a similar number of outbreaks in New South Wales.
This is the worst start to the bushfire season on record in Queensland. Dozens of fires are burning and several homes have been destroyed. Tracy and Dennis Beggs were forced to flee their property as the flames advanced.
Those fires went through the back there like a freight train. It was, I don't know, like a plane going past. They were moving so fast.
You could see the flames and you could just hear the roar of them.
More than 100 blazes are burning across northern New South Wales state and southern parts of Queensland. They've been fanned by high winds and tinder-dry conditions. The danger isn't expected to pass until Wednesday. Hundreds of firefighters have been deployed and dozens of homes have been saved from the blazes. A volunteer firefighter was badly injured when flames engulfed a fire truck near the town of Tenterfield, suffering serious burns to his hands, legs and face. A fire near the city of Armidale in New South Wales covers more than 60,000 hectares. Australia's entire east coast is facing an above-average risk of bushfires when summer starts. David Littleproud, the Minister for Natural Disaster and Emergency Services, says firefighters will be equipped to deal with the threats.
The reality is my job is to make sure that those men and women that are prepared to put their lives on the line for you and me have the equipment they need. They are given the tools and resources they need. They have the science to understand that these events could become more severe. And how do we equip them to actually not only keep us safe, but keep them safe?
Officials are warning some of the fires could burn for weeks. Experts say Australia's annual bushfire season is starting earlier and lasting longer. Climate change is a key factor, as is a long drought, which has exacerbated the fire threat, with summer still more than 2 months away. Most wildfires are caused by lightning strikes, while others are set accidentally by faulty power lines or farming equipment. Some, however, are the work of arsonists. Bushfires are a part of Australia's environment. Many of the nation's native plants are fire-prone and extremely combustible. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists generally agree that there were five major mass extinction events throughout Earth's history. A new study by Michael Rampino from New York University and Xu Zongshen from China's Nanjing University suggests that devastation from the end Guadalupean extinction some 260 million years ago was underestimated and should now be considered the sixth major extinction event. Professor Rampino, in an email to VOA, says an estimated 60% of marine species and possibly a similar number of non-marine species disappeared because of the mass extinction. This compares with the infamous dinosaur-killing KT extinction, where 70 to 75% of species were lost. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. British lawmakers have been sent home, giving Prime Minister Boris Johnson a respite as he decides his next Brexit move. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma starts things off.
The British government has formally suspended Parliament, sending lawmakers home for 5 weeks amid a Brexit crisis. Business was officially prorogued late Monday night with a formal ceremony, but only after House of Commons Speaker John Bercow voiced his displeasure, saying many regarded the move as an arbitrary announcement. There were raucous scenes in the House of Commons as opposition lawmakers chanted, "Shame on you," referring to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Parliament's suspension ended a day of blows to the embattled Johnson. First, an opposition-backed measure designed to stop Britain from crashing out of the EU on October 31st. That other divorce deal became law after receiving the formal assent from Queen Elizabeth II. The law compels the government to ask the EU for a three-month delay if no deal has been agreed to by October 19th. Johnson says the country's delayed exit must happen at the end of October with or without a divorce agreement to smooth the way. But many lawmakers fear a no-deal Brexit would be economically devastating and are determined to stop him. Legislators also demanded the government release by Wednesday emails and text messages among aides and officials relating to suspending Parliament and planning for Brexit amid allegations that the suspension is being used to circumvent democracy. Under parliamentary rules, the government is obliged to release the documents. The government said it would, quote, consider the implications of this vote and respond in due course, end quote. Early Tuesday, lawmakers rebuffed for a second time Johnson's request for an early election, which he said was the only way to break the deadlock in the House. Opposition parties voted against the measure or abstained, denying Johnson the two-thirds majority he needed. They want to make sure a no-deal departure is blocked before agreeing to an election. India's space agency says it has located the lunar probe that was feared lost as it was making its final approach towards the surface of the lunar area this past weekend. The Vikram lander was just 2 kilometers above the moon's south pole Saturday when ground controllers lost contact with the spacecraft. The Indian Space Research Organization on Tuesday said the Chandrayaan-2 probe has discovered the lander on the surface but has not yet been able to establish communications with Vikram, named after Vikram Sarabhai, the scientist regarded as the father of India's space program. If the probe landed intact, India will join the United States, Russia, and China as the only nations to achieve a soft landing of a spacecraft on the moon. It will also become the first nation to attempt a controlled landing on the moon's southern pole. And before we go today, we'll take a quick look back in time. It was on this day in 1813, an American naval force commanded by Oliver H. Perry defeated the British at the Battle of Lake Erie during the War of 1812. In 1846, Elias Howe received a patent for a sewing machine, a device which brought clothing into the modern age. In 1912, the jungle character Tarzan made his debut in Tarzan of the Apes by Edgar Rice Burroughs, which was first published in the All Story magazine. And in 1945, singer and guitarist Jose Feliciano, whose song Feliz Navidad happens to be a Christmas classic, he was born in Puerto Rico. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha, engineer Thomas Bondet, and managing editor Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth world events coverage and news at our VOA News website and on our mobile app. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Make it a great day.